Welcome to The Sharing Culture, the show that talks about sharing, who does it, why, the history, and a whole lot in between. I'm your host and executive director of Equal Giving Circle, AJ McCrary, and today we're talking with Miss Linda Tarrant Reed out of New Rochelle, New York. We're going to be talking to her about her book and her work as an organizer and her garden that she started out in New Rochelle. We have a book recommendation at the end and a sharing activity for all of you today. So make sure you listen all the way through so that you don't miss out. And we're looking forward to sharing with you all today. Welcome, welcome, Miss Linda.
Hi, AJ. Nice to see you.
You too. I was going to read your bio in your book.
Oh, please don't do
that. Okay, I won't do that. But I am going to shout out Miss Linda's book, which is called Discovering Black America from Age of Exploration to the 21st Century. I read it years ago when it came out. It's a beautiful book. And this is our book recommendation today. Miss Linda has done so many incredible things as a writer and an activist. She has worked with the Million Man March as a contributor. She's worked on some projects with BET. So definitely I will not read the bio, but she has done a lot of really incredible work over the, you know, her lifetime. And we're honored to get to talk to you today and learn a little bit about your work that you're currently doing in New Rochelle. For the very first part of the podcast, I'm just asking you some really rapid fire questions just to kind of get us warmed up and started.
Okay.
So the first one, what was the most favorite thing that anyone has shared with you?
The most favorite thing that... The most favorite thing that anyone has shared with me.
Yeah.
I have to say, my neighbor, an older Italian gentleman. I'm sorry. Hello. Okay, Gibby, I can't talk to you. I'm on the phone.
We'll just cut this out.
Yeah, she's on the phone. AJ, that's Gibby calling.
Hey, Gibby.
No, she's only upstairs. Okay, the most favorite thing that someone has given to me, my neighbor, an older gentleman named Neil G. Judice. He was of Italian heritage, and I grew up living next door to him. Currently, we're in the house that I grew up in. He moved away years ago, you know, to be with his son and his grandkids, but he taught me how to farm. Oh. He taught me how to plant tomatoes and to take care of crops. And he was just a lovely older gentleman who took the time to teach me how to grow food.
That's amazing.
That's the favorite. That's my favorite thing.
And now you've shared that with so many people.
Right.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
And it wouldn't have happened if, in fact, I hadn't been really watching him from my back porch. And looking at him through the hedges as he meticulously planted his tomatoes, his basil, and, you know, his lettuce.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally said, could you teach me how to do that? And he did.
I love that. That's beautiful. Neighbors are a good thing.
Yes.
Cool. What was the most meaningful thing that you've shared with somebody? There's no right or wrong answers. Just what is something
that feels
good?
The most meaningful thing that I've shared with someone is happening now. You know, we have this incredible food program called Grow Eat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a program where we actually grow the fresh vegetables. And we also partner with a sister farm in Purchase, New York, and we actually buy CSA shares from them, and we populate a mobile vegetable truck and take that truck to the neighborhoods where the food insecure live in Herschel. And that's predominantly senior citizens and low-income families, which are largely mothers and children. And we let them shop the truck, and the vegetables we harvest the day of, or, you know, the day before. And it's absolutely the freshest vegetables you could possibly, you know, eat. And it's locally grown produce delivered directly to their doors, free of charge.
That's amazing. I love to see it. I love to hear it. I had an opportunity to visit the garden this summer, and it was so beautiful and bountiful. And just, it's incredible to see how you have continued to cultivate this work. It's really, really magical.
Yeah, we're having a good time.
Good. I love it. What's something that you share the most, or that you share often?
Vegetables. Herbs.
I love it.
Occasionally, because a lot of young people have been attracted to our circle, which I really love that. So it's occasionally sharing little tidbits of advice, if they ask, and, you know, some words of wisdom. Because it's somebody that's lived almost three quarters of a century. I've got a lot to say.
I love it. You got a lot to share.
Right.
So this question always gets a really interesting response, because I will preface this with, I don't think that what, like, the work that Equitable Giving Circle, or that I do, or that you do, is truly radical. But in the world that we live in, liberation work, community work can be seen as radical. But what radicalized you? What inspired you to be such a community caregiver individual?
My parents did. They radicalized me. I mean, both of my parents were born in Florida. My father, Jacksonville, Florida, and my mother, Green Cove Spring, Florida. They met in New York, specifically Portchester, New York, and married and, you know, raised a family. And when they were growing up, in radical, racist Jim Crow Florida. And actually, my father and his brother had to leave because the Klan was very active, and he was a young, you know, boy, probably about 17 or 18. And he was actually in a fight with a group of white boys. I think they were boys. They probably weren't boys his age. And he ran away. And when he looked around the corner of the building to see if they were still chasing him, one of them threw a rock that caught him in his eye. And my father suffered a fatal eye injury that, you know, he lost his eye. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that was the determining factor for him to leave the South. So him and his younger brother hopped on a train to Pittsburgh, where they worked in the steel mills for a time, and then eventually got to Harlem, and then moved to Westchester, where there was a lot of people from Jacksonville, Florida, wow, and Green Cove Springs. So that, and the way my father worked once he, you know, came north, was totally inspiring. And he worked incredibly hard. But as hard as he worked in the fortune that he amassed, he always shared. Mm. He had a community store in his 60s. He had worked at Arnold Baker's for, you know, 25 years. And then when he retired, he opened a community store in the Black neighborhood and started feeding the community in the Lincoln Avenue corridor, where my garden is located now.
I didn't know that. So beautiful.
Yeah. And my mother worked in the store with him. Mm-hmm. And the young mothers who would be on welfare would come in, you know, around the middle of the month. And their checks, you know, they had spent, you know, the money on groceries over the previous 2 weeks, mm-hmm, and other expenses. So by the 15th of the month, they really didn't have any money for food. So they would come into my dad's store and ask if they could get credit. And he always gave them credit. Always, always. He said, get whatever you want, baby. Just write it down. And Juanita, my mother, put it in the cash register. And when they get money, they'll come and pay. And he did that every month for anybody that asked him.
Wow.
And even if you didn't pay him back, mm-hmm, he did not hold grudges.
That's amazing. We need more of that.
Yeah.
We do. That's amazing. Well, you come from obviously people that like very much care about community and have made that investment. So it makes sense how that has inspired and lived on with you.
Right.
Yeah.
And so the food insecurity part, I've seen that for all my life, and I've seen my family members, including my sisters, who ended up like in the restaurant business, you know, feed people. My sister Gwen Byrd, she had a restaurant in the Lincoln Avenue corridor before KFC, called Bird's Nest. And you could get, you know, chicken and french fries in a small tray for like $2.99. And, you know, people would just like drive up to the corner where her restaurant was. The traffic would be blocked and people would come in and get their little $2.99 chicken meals.
Hey, that sounds good. I love it. I love your roots in the community and the way that your whole family shows up. It's very inspiring.
Yes.
We definitely need more of that. I'd like to get into a little bit of just some of your work. So I have your book sitting with me today, which you wrote a while ago.
Right. That book was published in 2012.
Yeah.
I started my career. First of all, I went to an HBCU.
Shout out to HBCU.
I graduated from Hampton Institute in 1971, which is now Hampton University.
Woo-woo.
I was part of the class of 1971. We rioted. We occupied the administration building. Because that's what you did when you went to college in the 70s.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
And I remember calling my mother from the president's office in the administration building, you know, saying, Mom, guess where I am? And she said, where? I said, we took over the administration building. I'm in the president's office. She said, get your ass out of there.
She said, I sent you to learn, not cause issues.
But Mom, we have demands. She said, I have a demand. Get out of there. So, of course, I did what she said.
She said, my demand trumps yours right now.
Right, right.
That's
right.
Funny.
But, you know, that was kind of the beginning of my radicalization, mm-hmm, which is kind of wishy-washy.
That's funny.
It is funny. And then I went on a when I graduated, I had gotten a job at Doubleday and Company, the publishing company. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about being in college in the 70s, because of the civil rights movement, all of the corporations across America were mandated to hire Black skilled workers mm-hmm. in the corporations. So all of these corporations came down to Hampton's campus in the spring for, you know, a jobs fair. And I mean, every major corporation you can imagine was there. I did not want to work for a corporation per se, but I did take a shine to Doubleday Publishing. I said, majoring in English. I like to read. I like to write. This sounds like a good fit for me. So I interviewed. I got the job in April of 1971. I graduated in May of 1971. And I started work on Park Avenue in June 1971.
Amazing.
Yep. And I was just so pleased that I had this job, and it was really cool. I mean, you didn't have to dress up, you know. There were all these like really hip people mm-hmm. Who worked there. You were working with books and authors, you know, really famous authors. And I learned. I was in a training program with about 10 other people from various colleges, you know, the Seven Sisters colleges and all the really, you know, East Coast snobby colleges. And here I was from the little black school down south. And that was good.
Yeah.
Made a lot of friends and learned a lot about publishing because we went from department to department.
Okay.
You know, you learned about the science fiction books. You learned about the submission process. You learned how to write rejection letters. You went to the art department. You learned how they designed the book jackets. You know, and ultimately, you really did work for an editor, where you did all of that stuff. So I worked for this wonderful editor who did a lot of counterculture books.
Okay.
So the books that I worked on were, you know, like books that, like Tom Robbins, he was one of our authors. Okay. He wrote another Roadside Attraction and the book, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues Sometimes.
Oh.
And Tom Robbins, I mean, He's a literary giant, if you uh-huh. Google him. And he lived, where did he live? In Kodiak, Washington. And so the time zone was similar to California. So mm-hmm. we would have to call him, like, after 12, definitely. And more like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he didn't have a phone. He would go to the community store to answer the phone.
That's
where he would receive his call.
That's funny.
So we'd have to write him, make an appointment.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, so different. Different time for sure.
Right, right. And so, and even the editing, you know, of the manuscript by hand and then mailing it out.
Oh, wow.
And then he would mail back his, you know.
Uh-huh.
Answers to the questions we have.
I feel spoiled because we can just like edit in a doc together.
Right, right. It was no.
No, none of
the old-fashioned way.
Yeah. So when did you start becoming a published author?
Well, I moved to Washington to be with Stuart. You know Stuart, my husband, your friend, mm-hmm. and. It was very hard to get a job in Washington because it's really government based. Mm-hmm. Everything is government. I had gone from Doubleday to ABC TV during the time when ABC Television Network was number one. At that point, there were only three major networks. Cable TV was not quite a thing yet. Well, it wasn't quite there yet.
Okay.
And so there were the big three, CBS, NBC, and ABC. I worked for ABC. And I worked in primetime programming. And even though I came from publishing at that point, it was good because ABC was adapting books to the screen. And that's when they did Roots.
Okay.
That miniseries, Roots, mm-hmm. which was a Doubleday book.
Yeah. Oh. Right. Okay.
And I knew Alex Haley, the author.
Okay. Wow.
And I knew his editor, Lisa Drew. Alex must have worked on that book for 15 years.
Amazing.
And we went to a dinner, some kind of literary dinner. And I was sitting at the table with Alex's editor, Lisa, and he was the keynote speaker. And when he spoke about the book, it was like he was living the book. He would tell you the whole story.
Wow.
And Lisa said, I wish he would finish that fucking book. He's not submitted it yet. So it was pretty funny to, you know, sit there while he's telling the whole story of the book and he hadn't finished writing it. But the even funnier part was when he did finish it, he sold it to ABC for the miniseries. Oh my God, you hear that?
Wow. You're good. That's amazing.
Yeah, so I went to ABC just as they were airing mm-hmm. Roots.
Very
cool.
Which
was a smash.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow.
So really, they really wanted more and more books that okay. they could adapt.
All right. Did you, and you worked on that?
My job was, I have never... When I tell people the kind of job I have, they don't believe it. I worked in programming. Mm-hmm. It was called Primetime Development. And my job was to go to plays, go to movies, talk to producers about ideas that they had for television programming.
That's so cool.
And it could have been short form, could have been movie of the week. It could have been series,
okay,
dramatic or comedy. So I would go to off-Broadway plays. I would go to Broadway plays. I would go to comedy shows. I would go to concerts, all paid for, you know, expense account.
Yeah.
And I would have to have dinner with people, you know, to talk to them about their ideas. And then I would write up each of these events. And if I liked them, I would recommend them to my boss. And then if he thought there was something there, he would pursue it.
That's amazing. I might need to change careers. That sounds fun.
I don't know how they do that now. I really don't.
I don't either.
You know, they don't really have to go to, they just,
yeah.
You know, they can look at YouTube.
Yep. Or the TikTok. Is that the other one?
Right.
Will you tell us a little bit about your current work with the garden, and you have a new center that you have been working on? I got to see the sort of the skeleton this summer. I'm sure it looks different now.
Yeah, I'm the executive director of the Lincoln Park Conservancy, which is a 501c that we formed out of the garden, basically. We created and established a community garden in 2011, which was the 50th anniversary of the Lincoln School desegregation case. And the community garden is on the campus of the former Lincoln Elementary School. So we wanted to commemorate, you know, the students, the parents, and the educators who worked at Lincoln School, because it was such an incredible, you know, educational institution. And when they tore it down, the school district, we felt we needed to keep that story alive. And we're doing that with the community garden. So the community garden started off First of all, it's a public-private partnership with the city of New Rochelle because we're on public property. They gave us permission to create this 5,000 square foot farm with 30 raised beds. In 2015, we extended it another 5,000 feet. And so now it's 10,000 square feet. Plus, we have a 800 square foot native plant butterfly garden. Mm. So we're 10,800 square feet, 65 raised garden beds, half of which we lease to the community for $35 a season. The season begins April. And we say November, but climate change, I'm sure it's going to go until December.
Wow.
The season. And actually now the season starts in March. Some people start planting in March.
Wow.
Because the weather pattern has shifted in the 12 years so that, you know, people can grow.
It's amazing. It's really incredible space. I've gotten to watch it from afar. We were there when you guys were working on the butterfly garden, and it's so cool to see how big all of those plants are. It's really magical.
And we have, you know, botanical labels, that, you know, the kind that you see at the botanical garden that tells the Latin name of the native plants and the common name. Mm-hmm. And so when we have workshops, especially for kids, it's important for them to know and identify, you know, the native plants in the region. So we're really proud of that. So then we created the 501c3 because we wanted to get more funding for the programming that we, some of it we envisioned, other we didn't envision. And one of the programs is the Grow Eat program, which we are diligently working on right now. And what we're doing is we're expanding our growing space from 10,000 square feet to 22,000 square feet. We're going to grow on a rooftop farm, which is 8,000 square feet adjacent. It's a brand new building. It's 11 stories. Not occupied yet. The developer is a young person who is so excited about creating this sustainable space on top of his brand new building.
Cool.
So, and then for the designer of this space is a gentleman named Ben Flanner, who is the expert in rooftop farming. And he created Brooklyn Grange, which is this masterful, huge rooftop farm in Brooklyn. He also put a rooftop sustainable space on the Javits Center in New York City. So he's doing our rooftop farm. And are we excited that he's one of our partners?
That's super cool.
Yeah. And then the other farm, which the reason why, that's where I was today, is in back of the Boys and Girls Club in West New Rochelle, which is a predominantly Latino, Latinx community. And the Boys and Girls Club, 4,000 square feet farm behind it. So we're creating the farm now. We cleared it. This place had so many weeds and, you couldn't even see the ground. And so we got a contractor to come and just clear all the stuff. And we got this wonderful grant from Con Edison, our electric, you know, energy company. I don't know who you have in California, but that's a big deal to get them to work on this sustainable project.
Yeah. We have, I'm in Portland. I wish I was in California.
Oh,
no, you're making me weather envious. We have PGE as our electric.
What is that, Pacific Gas and Electric?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
something like that. I don't know. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, so Con Ed is, you know, New York State.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, they're very controversial because we have a lot of weather here. We have a lot of hurricanes, a lot of this, a lot of that, a lot of outages.
Yeah.
You know, the blackout of 1977, I think it was, where all of New York City went dark. People have not forgotten that.
No, no. It's a.
And then recently in 20, I forgot. With a whole, but this was a whole East Coast thing. It wasn't just Con Ed. I think it was the National Grid. It went out. Thank God it was during the day.
Yeah. I stay living by the freeways, so I seem to, like, always, I'd say I cannot seem to move away from a freeway. Always. It's ridiculous. So I seem to, like, luck out on the electrical issues, like blackouts, where like no one else's power will be like, nope, me and the freeway, we get to go over here.
They built them like that. You know that, right?
I mean, it is probably the major positive about living next to a freeway is that your electricity is probably going to stay on. Like, you know, I try to find the positive in that. Right. You stay busy. You stay so busy. It's cool to see how much work that you've done in food sustainability and food access, and still growing that work. And you've also created a cultural center, right?
Yes. Well, with the 501c3, we've been able to really get funding. It's amazing what that those, you know, 501c3 does. Corporate, I already told you about Con Ed, Verizon, the telephone company, they've been supported. And New York State has been supported. So we've been really lucky. And the city of New Rochelle has been a really staunch supporter of all of our projects. We do Juneteenth. We did the third annual citywide month-long Juneteenth celebration that the city, you know, awarded us funding for, which also went to the 18 participants because we believe in paying everybody. Lots of entertainment, poetry, comedy, exhibits, film screenings, marketplaces, concerts, drum lines, youth performances. I mean, it was Juneteenth in New Rochelle is amazing.
I'm going to have to come one year for Juneteenth. It sounds fun.
Yes, and we do the central event, which is on the holiday, and we do it on the campus of City Hall. And this year we had this Stuart. Stuart was the one who got all of the, you know, equipment and stuff. And so I said, I want a really good stage. I have stage envy because our stage the first 2 years is kind of small. It's lovely. We get it for free from Westchester County, but it's not very big. It's good, but it's not. So I told him, please get us a big stage. He called me from the venue on the day the stage was driven down the street. He said, Lynn, this stage is so big. So the stage, we were not supposed to be in front of City Hall, facing City Hall. It was supposed to be partially on the sidewalk, but it took up half the roadway.
Oh, my God.
Right. So when I got there, like at 7:30, 8 o'clock, I went, oh my God, this is huge in the morning. And the cops were like kind of freaked out a little bit, but they were cool. And then the guys who were putting up the stage, they said, oh, this was Beyonce's stage.
Hey!
This is the Today Show stage. I said, okay.
You have arrived.
This is great.
I love
that.
That was
a lot of fun. That was a lot of fun. That's and we awesome. Had great talent. I mean, we have world-class talent. I mean, last year we had Lakeisha Benjamin, who has blown up. She is amazing. You know, Sex Softness. Yeah. We had her last year. This year we had Sharonay Wade, Ray Blue, and Shunzo Ono. All global jazz greats.
That's incredible. And see,
that's what we like.
Yeah.
You know, and we're trying to get, Soraya Joy, what's her name?
Oh, I remember you shared. I started following her.
She is, we met her.
Yeah.
We told her we want you. And I mean, she's like 50 grand. It's going to take a bit. Uh-huh. She's a lot. But, she's wonderful. And we've seen her a couple of times. So that's what we have our eyes set. But so with all of that happening, the city is building. There are like 31 new buildings in development. Mm-hmm. And part of allowing this kind of burgeoning development, the city asked the developers to pay into a fund or to provide space for community organizations for free. Mm-hmm. So we were able to get the second space that was awarded to a 501c3. So we have an 1,100 square foot space, street level, and a brand new building that's going to be our history and culture center.
So cool.
And it's completed. The building's completed. Yep. The developer, his responsibility was to deliver us a clean white box. Mm-hmm. The box is done. And it's beautiful. And what we're going to build out there is we're putting a workshop kitchen, a digital a podcast studio, mm-hmm. and it's a gallery.
Yeah.
And we're also creating a digital archive for the Black community.
That's amazing. Wow.
You should come. We were thinking we were going to get it done by September, October, but I really think it's not going to be built out until spring of 2024.
Okay. Well, keep me posted. I would definitely love to come out, especially one of your big events, just to get to see you in action.
Yeah, opening.
Yeah. You definitely have tons of projects open and moving and shaking. Are there any, like, really... things in the future that you haven't quite touched yet that you're hoping to do?
Well, I don't know if I told you, but the governor of New York State appointed me a commissioner of New York State Parks, Recreation, and Historic Preservation for the Taconic region. Now, the Taconic region is one of like 7 regions in New York State. And the Taconic region goes from Yonkers to Albany.
Oh, wow.
The Taconic Parkway, essentially.
Okay.
Thus the name, Taconic Region. And the Taconic region has about 18 parks, state parks, mm-hmm. and historic sites. My commission, which has 5 commissioners, mm-hmm. we divide up the Taconic region into areas that we pay attention to. Mm-hmm. So my region is southern Westchester. It encompasses Yonkers to, I'd say, Katona, New York.
Okay.
And that includes Phillips Manor. You know, that includes the old Croton Aqueduct, the John Jay Homestead, in FDR Park. So those areas I pay particular attention to, you know, to see what their needs are so that I can lobby the governor and her office for funding for these locations. Mm-hmm. And Phillips Manor Hall just recently went through an entire remake. They went from a historic site to a digital, incredible museum that tells the story not just of the Phillips, the Dutch, British landowners, slaveholders, slaveholders and British sympathizers, but it tells the story of the enslaved who worked on the Phillips properties and the Native Americans who were, of course, on the property before anybody. So it's fascinating.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. And it's a beautiful restoration, reinvention, and everything's digital, you know, touch screen, you know, audio, dioramas. It's stunning. And it's in the original building on the Hudson River. It's beautiful. So they're doing that, New York State, us, historic preservation. We're doing that to a number of historic sites.
Okay.
In the historic sites, we're either willed to us by the families or we purchase them.
Okay. Wow. You just stay busy. You just stay moving and shaking. It is amazing.
I'm trying.
I love it. All right, so we're coming close to the end of our podcast today, unfortunately. Do you have a question for me?
So tell me a little bit about the organization and the things that you're doing and the podcast in particular. Who's your audience and how do you stream it? Where do you put it?
Yeah, so the podcast is a project that we've been doing with The Numbers, which is a local black radio station here in Portland. And they have a network, the podcast network. And so they are recording and streaming and uploading both onto their network, but also to Audio Boom, Apple Podcast, Spotify, sort of those big networks, and helping push it out. We just started. This is our first season with the podcast, and it's been going really well. At the end of this season, we'll have 12 episodes, starting with episode zero, and then a bonus episode. And we're really excited. I've been interviewing some of my team members, different community members, and activists in Portland, you. My goal with interviewing you is also just connecting food access work to another part of the country. And just I'm really blessed to have you in my network and be able to, you know, call you and connect with you. And since you are such an incredible organizer. So I just wanted to include you in your work. And we're next season with the podcast, we're going to be shifting a little bit where all of our director teams and some of our board members will become the interviewers and interviewing different community members having to do, you know, that are doing liberation work, that are activists, that are doing food access, housing, and community wellness work. So we are hoping to continue to grow this conversation. Right now, I mean, we launched in July 5th or something like that. Early July, and we've really haven't even been, it hasn't been out very long, and we have almost 500 listens, which is really great and exciting. Trying to grow that, just really trying to, you know, use this podcast platform as an opportunity for folks to get to know our work a little bit more, but also connect with different organizers, different groups. Each episode has a book recommendation and then a homework assignment. So we'll, and I'm recommending your book today because I think it's a really beautiful book for folks to read. And it's also accessible for little kids. I've actually read this to a younger person when they were at my house. So that's the podcast. Our work, you know, we're still doing food access, housing work, and community wellness work. Our food access program, we have two parts of it. For both of those parts, we buy our produce from black and brown farmers. We have a home delivery, so we're delivering to, I think, like 325 families at this time.
That's a lot.
Yeah, every single week. And then we see another about 120 or so families at our free pantry on Thursday. And we're trying to acquire a building so that our free pantry can turn into a free store.
Nice.
And offer, you know, more resources. Currently, our pantry does, you know, food and plants and other depending on what we pull in, miscellaneous items. Like, we had our big back to school event, but then we also did some backpacks at Pantry, for folks that, you know, didn't make it out to the event. So that's kind of what's happening with our food programming, and we really do want to grow it. It's a we've proven that it's a sustainable way to do food programming. We never serve expired food. We never, we don't serve things that we wouldn't serve to our most beloved community members, like in our own personal as organizers. So we, you know, if I wouldn't serve it to you, I'm not serving it to somebody else.
And isn't that interesting, AJ? Yeah. That I didn't realize until we started working, distributing food, that a lot of these food pantries, they get their food from, it's recovered food.
Yeah.
And then sometimes the fresh food, a lot of it, because of the transportation and the refrigeration, the food is wilted or not good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that sometimes the recovered food, if it's meat and fish, it's on the edge.
Yep. Yeah. And we really push back about against that, right? Like, feeding oppressed people, particularly when you go into history, feeding enslaved people expired food was a common norm. Leftover scraps, you know. Anybody, you can read about it. You can go Google it. This is not making this up. And so for food access programming to hold on to that legacy of giving oppressed people food that is expired, like, that's a playbook out of chattel slavery. And we just, as organizers and humans, are not interested in participating with that. So we're real adamant about serving high quality items.
And we are too. And I, like, again, when I start some of these things, I'm not really thinking deeply. Mm-hmm. It's almost organic.
Yeah.
So, of course, I said, oh, I'm going to feed people, you know, freshly harvested, locally grown produce.
Yep.
And then I was partnering with somebody, and they started putting stuff on the truck. And I said, where did this food come from? And then I finally said to them, please don't put anything on the truck. We're going to populate the truck ourselves.
Yeah.
So even with that, I went to Costco in New Rochelle, created a relationship with them where I can go on a Thursday, every Thursday, and they will give me fresh produce that they can't sell because the package ripped, not because it's out of date. Because, and they said, well, do you want prepared foods too? I said, no. Even though I know it's, you know, probably fresher than what I've seen, I don't want to get into that.
Yeah, it's we often regularly have to, like, toe that line with folks of, like, you know, we do, there are certain things like that makes sense, and then there's other things, but in the industry, a lot of folks just, they don't think about it, like, from a full, like, the whole, you know, the whole circle, or, like, how it's going to feel on the other end, or even that it's just not the responsibility of oppressed people to be the garbage disposals of capitalism and deal with all of this old expired food.
Yeah. Right. So I'm learning a lot. I'm also learning that some of these big distributors of the recovered food, they charge the food pantries to, you know, to take the food.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
There's a lot within this food access space. Yeah, I've learned a lot along the way. And it's often, you know, controlled in wild ways. Like, an issue that we've come up against is Feeding America would give us dollars, except all of their Oregon dollars goes to the Oregon Food Bank. And Feeding America has given the Oregon Food Bank dollars explicitly for Black and Brown programming, right? Food access programming. Oregon Food Bank has no idea what we're talking about.
So
it's such an interesting... Well, we're not in community with the Oregon Food Bank. They do the expired food thing, and it's a hot mess over there. But and they know that we feel that way. you know, but it is interesting, like, how layered this is, and if you're not in it, like, I think a lot of people make assumptions about food access work and community care work. Like, it should work like this. This would be the logical things. But then when you're in it, it's not.
I don't think people do not know, you know, they just see people standing in line.
Yep.
They see people with these plastic bags with food that, you know, people don't even know what's in it. They don't even have a choice. They're just given the bags.
Yeah.
There's a lot going on, just like you said, a lot of layers. Yeah.
So in addition to our food programming, and I'll just be real fast, we have our housing programming where we've put $200,000 into the community in 3-month rent and mortgage relief grants. And we're trying to find more dollars to be a stopgap to make sure that folks aren't falling into houselessness, because it's one of the most proactive ways to address this housing crisis. But we're also looking for dollars so that we can buy a building and pilot supporting some Black single mothers in housing with and food free of charge, so they can like heal, breathe, stabilize. And we want to house folks for maybe like 3 to 5 years, and ideally on the when they're leaving, when they graduate, we'll be helping them buy property, because we really want to be addressing both like the stopping folks from falling into unhoused, being unhoused, as well as moving folks through the process and getting folks, you know, into properties that they own, because that's the most proactive way to build generational wealth. And getting Black folks back into property is a real big passion of ours. And then our third programming is our community wellness, and that looks like our plant jam, where we collect and give out plants. It looks like our care packages, Black History Month. We do a big care package initiative, mostly supporting Black elders in Portland, and it's one of my favorite activities. I love just even chatting with the different folks that get boxes. And we do hundreds of boxes and deliver those directly to people. And then we have our large-scale community events for starting with Earth Day, Mother's Day, Juneteenth, back to school, and then holiday extravaganza. And we also do workshops, and like we have a game night coming up. So for us, community wellness really looks at, like, how are we taking care of the community? How are we sharing resources? What kind of connectivity are we, you know, cultivating? And, you know, EGC, or Equitable Giving Circle, is still a really young organization. We're only 3.5 years old. We have touch points with over 2,500, you know, Black and brown folks in the Portland metro area that we're doing support and service with annually, and just trying to grow it. That's what we do, and it's, you know, it's a labor of love. And
it sounds like it. How many people do you have working with you?
Right now there is, we just hired somebody, 7 of us. We've
7
got
people.
Yeah. Well, so there's 7 of us that are, you know, staff folks that do different roles. And then we have an active volunteer base of about 70 volunteers help with a variety of stuff. And then we have 7 board members who are, our board is much more active than other boards. They attend meetings. They help move work. We actually just brought in a new board member who actually interviewed me for episode 0, Morgan Jones. I'm really excited to have her now on the board. That just happened. But we're, you know, we're a young organization trying to grow. We're millennial Black woman led, which is like 2 very unique things in this part of the country. Even though Portland is a millennial city, you don't see tons of millennials in positions of leadership. It's an interesting place here. But, you know, we're really lucky to be doing this work. And we as a group don't really think about it as just like our work. This is legacy work. We are, you know, inspired by so many folks that came before us. And these aren't new concepts that we're doing. We're just like putting them together in like our own calendar, if you will, or our own way. But this is just, this is legacy work. And we talk about Booker T. Watley being the founder of the CSA program, a black man out of Tuskegee University. And a lot of people don't know that. Like, people think CSA or community supported agriculture is this like white concept for white people.
Booker T. Washington?
No, Watley. Booker T.
I don't know that name.
Yeah. I'll send you a picture of his book.
Okay.
Yeah. He created the CSA model.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, send me that.
Yeah. So, you know, we're just trying to grow, and it's exciting. It's food access work, absolutely, and housing and community wellness, you know, it's a need in the community everywhere.
It is.
Yeah, so that's a little bit about us. I do want to plug your 501c3 so listeners can find you and donate. Money Moves
This
Work.
Okay, so we have a wonderful brand new website. Okay, so it's tlpcinc.org, the Lincoln Park Conservancy Inc.org.
Amazing. And we will link this in the show notes so that folks can find it as well.
Okie dokie.
Yeah.
Good.
Awesome. And just as everyone knows, we do is every episode, Equitable Giving Circle, equitablegivingcircle.org. We're always looking for volunteers and donors as well. Money Moves This Work. So I really encourage everybody listening to please sign up as a donor, both with us and with the Lincoln Park Conservatory. Can't say it more. Money Moves This Work. Like, ideas are ideas, but these ideas cost dollars to turn into action, and we need more of it. Our book recommendation today is Miss Linda's book, Discovering Black America from the Age of Exploration to the 21st Century, and it is a beautiful book. Beautifully written. There's so many pictures and images to look at, which is really cool. Like, this is a book that lives on near my coffee table. I like to, especially when little kids are over, it's a cool book to talk about. You can like flip to a page, read a little bit, chat about a photo. It's very informative. It's very approachable. Sometimes I recommend books that nobody but me wants to read. This is not one of them. So please check it out. And our sharing assignment today that every episode, you know, we want to encourage folks to do a sharing activity. And today I'm going to invite everybody to initiate an uncomfortable conversation or do something that's hard that you've been avoiding. Miss Linda is a person that has obviously taken hard things by the reins and just pushed through and is very inspiring. She has done a lot of incredible work in her immediate community in the state of New York and beyond. And so I hope everybody who's listening is inspired to face something that's hard, that seems like an impossible task, and to do it. Have that conversation, jump in headfirst, and just, you know, go for it. Because as you can hear with this incredible organizer and activist and author, you just got to do it. You got to just jump in and do it, or nothing gets done. And she has,
that's true.
She's created incredible work, and I hope you're all inspired by her work, her vision, her love for community, and sharing food. And that is
AJ, thank you. This has been wonderful.
Thank you.
It's been a wonderful conversation, and I am very happy that we were able to do this.
Yes, yes, yes. Thank you. And I'll be sure to send over the episode, and we will be sharing it with our network. And on my personal, I've shared photos of the garden, but I will share on our EGC Instagram so folks can see how beautiful.
Well, and we're on Facebook also.
Yeah.
At Grow Lincoln Park. And that's the latest up to the minute, you know, photography and events and the things that we're doing.
Yeah.
So Facebook is very accessible.
Yes. We will definitely share. And thank you. I appreciate all of y'all listening and look forward to sharing with you all again next time.